In the distance were sounds of thudding feet as the golem guards came at speed and quickly spread out. Nobby raised his voice and said, "We'd better tell them that the others will be 10 miles away by now, Sarge, at the speed they were going, and I think old Vimesy might give us a day off in lieu for this night's work."
"But look," said Colon, "we've been patrolling past that locomotive time and time again, and nothing has happened to us."
"We weren't proposing to smash her up now, were we, Sarge?"
"What? Are you saying Iron Girder knows who her friends are? Do me a favour. She's only a lump of old metal."
And in the silence, something made a little clinking noise. Colon and Nobby held their breath.
"Wonderful machine, though, ain't she, Nobby? Look at those beautiful smooth lanes."
There was another pause as breaths continued to be held, and Nobby said,
"Well, the golems are here now, Sarge, and it's the end of our shift. I'll write a fulsome report as soon as we get back to the yard. Oh, and that reminds me, you've got to give me my pencil back."
The two of them perambulated away at impressive speed, and for a while Iron Girder was alone. And then there was a very small sound that appeared to be half whistle and half giggle. Sooner or later, everything to do with the railway passed across Moist's desk, and generally he hastened it all along its way. Today, he was looking across the paperwork at a clearly embarrassed Dick Simnel. "Now, come on, Dick. You tell me what you think happened last night. It seems as if the Grags were setting about to put more than a dent in Iron Girder. This could be connected with the attack on the railhead, but there were some significant differences. I expect there are a lot of ways of putting a locomotive out of commission, but the watch was on the scene within minutes, and according to them, she fought back and got one of the murderous band. I know the two watchmen of old, and every fight they have is always against much bigger forces. At least that's what they say if no one else is around. But it does seem that she got her retribution in first, you might say, and boiled him. They're still mopping the floor. How do you think that happened, Dick? Was it magic of some sort?"
Simnel blushed and said, "Mr. Litvig, I'm an engineer. I don't believe in magic, but I'm wondering right now whether magic believes in Iron Girder. Every day when I come into work, there are the train spotters, always there, and now they've got little sheds of their own, have you noticed? They almost know more about her than I do, I tell thee. And I look at people who are still taking rides, I look at their faces, and they're not the faces of engineers. They're more like the faces of people going to church. And so I wonder what's happening. No, I can't tell you how Iron Girder killed the dwarf who was trying to kill her, and why she's never done it while everyday folk are around. That looks like thinking to me, and I don't know how she thinks."
Dick was glowing red now, and Moist felt sorry for the engineer who lived in a world where things did what they were told, all the little numbers adding up, all the calculations dancing to the rattle of the sliding rule just as they should. But now he was in a conceptual world where the authority of that sliding rule held no sway. Dick looked desperately at Moist and said, "Do you think it possible that an engine like Iron Girder has a soul?" "Oh dear," thought Moist, "he's really having problems here." Out loud he said, "Well, I see you move your hands over her once she's stopped, and it seems to me that you're petting her. And I notice that all the other drivers do that too. And although the flyers have numbers, I notice that the drivers give them names and even talk to them. In expletives occasionally, but nevertheless they're talking to a mechanical thing. I do wonder if life is catching somehow, because I also notice that every time people go for joyrides on Iron Girder, they pat her too, and they would swear they don't know why. But what do you think?"
"Eh, I know what you mean. In the early days, when I were just getting started, I remember I spoke to Iron Girder all the time, and shouted often enough, and occasionally swore as well, especially if she were truculent. Ah, you might have a point. There's a lot of me in her, a lot of me blood and buckets of me sweat and many, many tears. I lost the end of one thumb to her, and most of me fingernails are blue, and I suppose, when you think about it, there really is a lot of her in me."
He looked ashamed when he said that, and so Moist quickly jumped in with, "I think you're right, Dick. It's one of those times when you have to stop thinking about how and why, and just remember that whatever's happening is working, and it might just not work if anyone gets smart and tries to find the soul of what's happening. There are times when a sliding rule just doesn't cut the mustard,
and if I was you this morning, I'd get her all sleek and shiny and let her see her worshippers and feel their worship. They're yearning for something, and I don't know what it is, so drink up the gravy and don't spoil things with too much thinking or too much worrying either. And I promise you I won't mention a word of this conversation to anyone." And then he brightened up and said, "Come on, Dick. Life is good. Has your sliding rule allowed you to come to an arrangement with Miss Emily?" Simnel blushed. "Aye, we've been doing some talking, mostly about Iron Gerda, and her mam's letting me come to tea with her tomorrow." "In that case, I suggest you get yourself a new shirt, you know, one that isn't greasy, and clean your boots, and your nails, and everything else. And now you're getting loaded up with money, you must get yourself a sharp new suit. I know a few places that'll give you a good deal." He sniffed and added, "And have a bath, why don't you, for the sake of Miss Emily?" Dick blushed further and grinned. "Right you are, Mr. Litvig. I wish I could be Deb on air like you are." "It's easy, Dick. You've just got to be yourself. They can't ever take that away from you." And when Moist left his desk for another look at where last night's excitement had taken place, he met Harry King, dressed to the nines and dressed to the maximum. Harry flourished a bow tie at Moist and said, "I hate these damn things. I mean, what's the point?" he growled. "Got another bloody civic thing on tonight. Effie just thrives on them. I told her I'm busy what we're dealing with the railway, but she's determined to make a better man of me. And all this business about what knife and fork you eat from, it's a deliberate puzzle set out to make a simple bloke like me feel like a stranger. Whatever you pick up isn't going to change what the food tastes like, but Effie presses my knee hard if I gets it wrong. She wants me to have electrocution lessons, gods be damned, and I'm putting my foot down about that one. Knobs or not, I'm still Harry King, and I'm still going to sound like Harry King. And I told Effie that I don't mind giving the money away to orphanages and such like. I like to see the faces of the little kiddies light up like daisies. It's the swank I don't like, and all the incessant chattering when I could be doing good work in my office. Effie says it's noblesse oblige, but it just because I got a lot of knobs, I don't have to accept it, right? It's a terrible thing when a man can't be himself, knobs or no knobs." 50 miles turnwise of Ankh-Morpork lies the Effing Forest, a source of laughter for some, but nevertheless, throughout the year, full of birdsong and, surprisingly, the occasional logger, as well as the family-run coal mines that are too small for the dwarfs to covet, but just about big enough to scratch a living. On this fine morning, in the Wesley family forge, Crucible Wesley was arguing with his brother. "OK, you're a blacksmith, granted, but that engine looked complicated too, oi. Jed, you're a good smith and a big lad, but I can't see you hammering out a whole locomotive on your own. You need a bit more of the book learning, say oi. You saw those boys at that there compound in the smoke with their sliding rulers, although you couldn't quite work out what them was for." The aforesaid Jed, dripping perspiration and stink, looked up from his anvil. "Look, it's simple. You boils up the water, you boils it up really hot, and that drives the pistons, and it's them as turns the wheels. There ain't really that much to it, apart from the oiling and the greasing. I reckon that stopping it once started will be the hardest thing to do." Crucible Wesley, considered by locals as the brains of the outfit, insofar as the outfit had any brains, was nervous about this and went on, "I know you were blacksmith of the year in Scrope 3 years running and got the silver cup that our mam's so proud of, but I dunno. I reckon there's somewhat more to it than that. It's trade secrets and whatnot." Jed appeared to commune with the spirits for a while, and then he announced, "Well, I've got the boiler half done, and that's a fact. And I reckon that if we takes it slowly, there shouldn't be nothing to worry about. After all, I seen steam coming out of Mam's kettle. 'Tis only wet air after all." He thumped the boiler, standing on its makeshift pedestal next to his workbench, with one enormous hand. "Come on, help me outside with this, and us'll give it a go. We can always shut her down if she looks like she's turning on us, and I reckon I can outsmart a bloody kettle." They carried the huge vessel outside, although, truth to tell, Jed proudly picked up most of the weight on his own. His brother watched in admiration and a certain amount of trepidation, or it would have been trepidation had he known the word existed. As it was, he could feel sweat trickling down his back. He started edging away, backwards, and once again he tried to remonstrate with his elder brother. Well, I dunno, Jed. They was doing all those measurements and things like that with levers and such like, and when it was hissing, it damn well hissed.
Yeah, and it cost we $1 to see it. Don't ye worry about a slipping stick. Like I said, I reckon I got more brains than a boiler. And if it gives oi any problem, then I'll hammer it out into horseshoes. Come on, I'll get the fire going and you can help oi pump the bellows.
After Crucible had managed to help his brother set the boiler up in the clean, open air amongst the trees, he had one last stab at trying to crowbar some sense into the dialogue.
I reckon it's too difficult. Otherwise, I should hear about other folk doing it as well.
But to his dismay, this suggestion only served to make his brother even more determined to tame the steam, because the man said, tapping the side of his nose,
"That's because I reckon they weren't as clever as I."
There is something vaguely worrying about the word reckon that leaves the ear, for many hard-to-understand reasons, wishing it was something else a little more certain and a little less frightening. And as bad luck would have it, some 20 minutes later, an ear was exactly what spiralled down out of the settling, steaming fog and through the mangled trees that looked as if they had been scythed by dragons, and the birds that were coming down cooked. Moist was, by inclination, a stranger to the concept of 2 in the morning, a time that happened to other people. He didn't object to a certain amount of early al fresco when he was on the road, especially on the railroad, which was more like camping and therefore fun, but to be awakened in his own bed in the small hours was an abomination. That cried to the heavens for justice, although he did not cry at Sir Harry, who had just arrived in Schoon Avenue with all hell following him. Crossley, the butler, rushed to get in front of Sir Harry, as etiquette required, but Sir Harry swarmed up the stairs, waving a clax flimsy at anyone he could see, and burst into Moist's bedroom, booming,
"Someone has been buggering around with a steam contraption and has managed to kill 2 people, including himself, down in the effing forest. And do you know what? Claxman on the Scroat Tower spotted the explosion, then went out and found the carnage. And you know the Claxman. The news is already all over the bloody place. And so apparently are bits of the poor buggers. 2 people dead, Mr. Lipwig. The press'll have our guts for garters."
By this time, Moist had managed to get his pants on the right way up. He spluttered, "But, Harry, we aren't doing anything in the effing forest at the moment. There's going to be a little branch line that goes to Scroat, and that'll be a very good earner, but this is nothing to do with us. Crossley, please get Sir Harry a stiff brandy and a soft chair."
"Nothing to do with us or not, Moist. You know the press will be round us like flies on a midden."
Moist said, to the annoyance of Harry, "Trust me, Harry. Trust me. It wasn't us, and I see no reason to worry. I'll deal with the press. I imagine they'll all be going to the effing place as soon as it gets light, so if you don't mind, I'll head there right now and be ahead of the game."
"It's no bloody game," Harry boomed.
And over his shoulder, Moist said, "I'm sorry, but it helps to think of it like that, Harry." Just as Moist was heading down the stairs with Harry simmering behind him, Adora Bell arrived home. She sometimes worked nights on the Grand Trunk. She told Moist that it was to keep people on their toes, but he knew that she actually loved the quiet watches of a clear night when messages would twinkle from hill to hill like fireflies. That was the spell of the clacks, and it wasn't only goblins who felt it. Adora Bell knew and didn't mind that the clacksmen and clackswomen would fraternise along the wonderful scintillating lines of light. After all, quite a few marriages had been brokered through the unsuspecting ether in the small hours of the night, and sooner or later little clacksmen and women would be born. Adora Bell had once told Moist, "You know that it takes a special kind of person to be a clacksman, and especially a clackswoman. And it's important that they marry and have children with the right kind of blood. They're our future, and heaven help them if their spouse doesn't also work on the clacks. Clacks people are a type, and like attracts like." When Moist told her the news of the accident in the effing forest, she disappeared into her office, and Moist could hear the goblins stampeding towards it, and then a rattle of the clacks on the roof. Before long, she sent down another goblin with a flimsy that said, "News from Scroat, stop. It's a boiler that burst, stop. Not a train, stop. Horrible deaths of 2 people, but no engine as such, stop." That latest discovery made Moist doubly sure of himself, and he clamped his hand on Harry's shoulder and said, "Please don't worry, Harry. I know how this one's going to go. All I need is for you and Mr. Simnel to meet me in the effing forest as quickly as you can. And oh, I think we might need Thunderbolt. It was time to talk to the Golem horse once more. Moist was rather concerned about taking it on another long journey so soon, but the horse said,
"Sir, I am a horse. Being a horse is my passion in life, and getting to the effing forest will be a breeze. Saddle up, please, and let's be off."
Moist had found something like a sweet spot in the gate. No muscle and bone horse could possibly gallop at this speed without legs getting tangled, but even so he covered the 50 miles to the effing forest by sunrise without much in the way of groinal sprains. He immediately sought out the nearest pub to the accident, which was the premises of Edward Forefather, purveyor of fine beers, stouts and ales. At least that's what it said on the rather large plaque behind the bar, and Moist was not going to argue. The publican, already up and dressed, looked him up and down and said,
"I've been expecting somebody like you. You're from the city, aren't you? It's about the explosion, isn't it? Are you one of them reporters? Only I wants money if you're a reporter."
Moist said, "No, I'm not. I'm with the railway. I heard about the explosion and came to see what had happened." Forefather looked him up and down again and said,
"We know all about it. It was them Wesley brothers. How good is your stomach, young man? Of course, I'd leave the bar to help you, but that means I'd have to get my wife up to start on the early shift for the miners. They'll be coming up for their breakfast soonish."
Moist understood the unspoken request and handed the man a reasonable sum, then followed him outside, where he was led along a path into the forest. This part of the forest was quite pleasant, not too dark, the kind of place where people would go for a picnic. But as they got in further, Moist could see that whatever they were going to find next, it wasn't going to be a picnic. In a clearing, just a short walk from the pub, the trees were stripped of their leaves, tangled wood was everywhere, and the remains of the forge were embedded in various trunks. And there were fragments of the stricken boiler, too, some of them driven so hard into mighty oaks that Moist couldn't pull them out. The haze in the clearing sent a chill down his spine. He took a deep breath and said, "What happened to the bodies, Mr. Forefather?"
"Oh, yes, sir. I've got them back in my cellar, it being quite cold down there. They're in a bucket. It isn't a big bucket either. It was two brothers, strapping great lads. Crucible was the brains and Jed was the blacksmith. Although in the bucket I couldn't tell you which bits were whose. Jed was boasting about building a railway engine one day, and to tell you the truth, sir, he was a very good blacksmith. But what he knew about locomotives I wouldn't dare think of. But he thought he could do it, and all his mates were egging him on."
He hesitated for a moment and then said,
"I was the first one to arrive here, and mostly all there was a mist, and I didn't like that at all. It was clammy and hot and made you want to puke. And that's it, sir. Not much more to be said, sir."
Moist looked up and said, "Should there really be an anvil up in that tree?" The publican looked at him and then at the tree and said,
"You're a man with his eye on the business, aren't you? Generally speaking, the anvil has always been on the ground, by and large, but it was a most powerful bang."
Moist brightened up as best he could and said, "Thank you, Mr. Forefather. Pretty soon there'll be a lot of journalists coming to see all this, and I'm sorry about that, but they turn up like flies."
"That's all right, sir. Good for business. Journalists drink twice as much as anyone else and for twice as long. We had them around when the mine fell in, and they can really take their liquor."
Mr. Forefather was rubbing his hands in anticipation. In fact, it was mid-morning before most of the journalists put in an appearance. But well ahead of the pack was Otto Schriek of the Ankh-Morpork Times, who was always first on the scene. It would be impolite to ask Otto how he got around so quickly. Of course, everybody knew that he was a vampire, but he was a fervent black ribboner, and so whatever anybody thought they knew about him, they didn't talk about it. As for the rest of the press gang, they arrived at cross purposes, all of them expecting the others to tell them what was going on. Mr. Forefather was making hay by making bacon butties, while his wife was frying eggs and the obligatory slice. Moist put the word out that, while of course the railway was in no way involved, the owners were coming to see the accident site for themselves and would be happy to answer questions. By the time Harry King, Simnel and Thunderbolt arrived, Moist could see Forefather carefully raising the prices on his beers as gradually the pub filled from across the Stow Plains. Moist had already gleaned from Mrs. Forefather that the brother's old mum was being comforted by friends back in her own home, a short walk from the pub, and he was careful to see that no mention of this or the current whereabouts of the unfortunate Wesley brothers was made to the gang of journalists. And he surprised himself by realising that this was a sensible and humanitarian thing to do. some of the press gang being the sort who would most definitely say things like, "Well now, Mrs. Wesley, how did you feel when you found out that both your sons had been melted?" As the press seized on the new arrivals, Moist, like a chess grandmaster, tried to keep his king, that would be Sir Harry King, away from the worst questions, and instead played his shining knight, Mr. Dick Simnel. He was learning a lot from Mr. Simnel. They faced him with questions like, "What do you say to people who think that live steam will kill everything in the end?" To which Dick's answer was, "I don't know, sir. I've never met anyone who thought that. Steam is very dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, and I feel sorry for them poor boys." Hardwick, of the Pseudopolis Daily Press, said, "I hear your own engine killed someone the night before last. What do you have to say about that, Mr. Simnel?" Before Dick could speak, Thunderbolt came down like a judge and said, "The person in question was clearly trying to sabotage the locomotive, and while we naturally regret the fatality, he was in a place where he shouldn't have been, doing something that he shouldn't have done. It is evident that he entered the engine shed through a skylight, which seems to show lawful business was not on his mind. His death, alas, was self-inflicted."
"And what about Mr. Simnel Senior?" said Hardwick. "Was his death self-inflicted?"
Simnel took the floor once again.
"It just goes to show you have to treat steam with respect. And yes, I learnt hard way when me dad died, and that's why I measure and test and measure it again. It's all about little numbers. It's all about taking care. It's all about getting the knowledge. Steam has its rules. After all, we call it live steam for a reason. It's dangerous in wrong hands. But my hands, sir, have spent a long time building boilers and static engines just to see how far I could go. That generally meant me hiding behind a stone wall while bits of engine whistled over me head. You learn by your mistakes, if you're lucky, and I tried to make mistakes just to see how that could be done. And although this is not the time to say it, you have to be clever, and you have to be smart, and you have to be humble in the face of such power. You have to think of every little detail. You have to make notes and educate yourself, and then, only then, steam becomes your friend. Like Iron Gerda. You've all seen her." "Yes, miss."
Moist recognised Saccharissa Cripslock. She said,
"You speak so caringly of your locomotive, Mr. Simnel, and so I have to ask, do you have a sweetheart?"
There was a certain amount of tittering from the hacks, but Simnel barely blinked.
"Why, thank you for asking, and yes, there is indeed a young lady who is looking at me kindly."
Simnel turned towards another waving notebook and said,
"Yes, sir."
"Grievous, sir, Grievous Johnson from the Big Cabbage Gazette. Is it your intention to share your knowledge with others trying to build their own engines? That might save a lot of lives."
Simnel glanced at Moist, and Moist looked at Harry King, who dropped an eyebrow, which Moist knew he could take as a yes. Simnel knew it too, and had spotted the signal. He said,
"Oh, yes, sir, we will do. At least the basics, safety and so forth, but it'll cost. Research and development has to cost. But I'll take apprentices, show them ropes, and generally make them safer workers. In fact, we're planning regular classes, a railway academy, you might call it."
His smile dropped as he continued,
"Of course, I'm reet sorry about these lads, sir, but learning is hard and failure is sharp. I'd hate that kind of thing to happen again, but it's got to be done proper-like. No scrimping, no cutting corners."
Mr. Simnel had won again. The press couldn't deal with a straightforward man. The certainty in his face simply disarmed them, and possibly, thought Moist, made them wish they were better people. There wasn't an inch of politics in him, and that stunned them. Simnel was still beaming at them.
"Aye, if any of you'd like to come back to work at Ankh-Morpork at any time, I'll gladly show you around. I'll show you everything."
Far away from Moist, and certainly from common sense, the Grags took counsel, if it could be called that. Things in the outside world were changing so fast.
"We are losing, do you know that?" said a voice in the darkness.
"It can't be helped. It's the Zeitgeist. It's in the air," said another voice, sounding somewhat more cracked.
"And what do we care about the air or any kind of geist? We are the justified, the stalwarts, the kings and servants of the darkness. Our people will come back."
"No, they're leaving. Burning Clax Towers were stupid,
I say stupid. Everybody wants their news, and it makes us look like criminals, which we are, and that's not justified."
A dwarf who had been silent during the conclave in the cavern was remembering the old Jelly Baby legend about the way to get an ass down from the minaret. And, of course, the answer was you first have to teach it not to be an ass. But in what world could that ever happen when you're dealing with Grags? It was, she thought, time to see for herself just how life was in the lands of the Troll King. She had been very careful, oh dear, so very careful, and so she had survived, she hoped, to be the jackass that got out of the minaret. But alas, the idiots were still encouraging impressionable young dwarfs to attack the Clax Towers. Whoever had had that idea had doomed them without dialogue. Rhys Reason was right, she thought. We've lost all balance. We have to get out of here, out of everything that is here, out into the light. Surely, she thought, they wouldn't suspect her. She had been forensic in her search for unbelievers. Nevertheless, when at last she ran, the knives got her before she stumbled. And then there were eight left in the cavern, and those watching in the darkness watched more closely to see who would be next. The time would be coming when the purity of darkness could not be mocked. The terrible fact was that when dwarfs schism, they schism. Every deviation from the norm was treated as an attack on all that was truly dwarfish. Others had already fled and died, and who could say they knew how many more were left, not only in this cavern, but in other caverns all the way to Uberwald. And the trouble with madness was that the mad didn't know they were mad. The Grags came down heavily on those who did not conform and seemed not to realise that this was like stamping potatoes into the mud to stop them growing. Everywhere one looked, there were committees nowadays, mostly because, by arrangement and with the blessing of Lord Vetinari, other principalities, large towns and city-states saw no reason to wait for the completion of their slice of the magic of the train, and seizing these opportunities, new companies were entering the railway business with rather more success than the Wesley brothers. Drumknot was in his element as the paperwork mounted and his files multiplied. He contrived to be everywhere and into everything, ably supported by Mr. Thunderbolt. There were committees discussing industry standards, public safety, passenger welfare, whether one company's freight truck could be hitched to another company's train to complete its journey without needing to offload. A development that proved fatal to the Brassica Carriage Company, which had elected to construct its engines and tracks to a gauge based on the horse-drawn cabbage delivery carts. And all the knotty financial and legal arrangements that would entail. The whole proposition of other businessmen launching their own railways had made Harry call for Thunderbolt. After hearing Harry's complaints, the lawyer said, "It's a matter of patents, Sir Harry. You know, all that fiddly stuff that you said you paid other people to get their heads around. Well, Mr. Simnel and I have filed applications for every one of his innovations. But I'm sure there is more than one way of building a machine to run on rails. You cannot patent the idea of a railway as such. And if you take a walk down the street of cunning artificers, you will find someone quite bright enough to discover how to make a train that will run on rails without infringing any of the patents I have been able to obtain for you. The idea of steam locomotion as such has been there for all to see, and we all know that a boiling kettle will try to lift its own lid. Being clever, some young man watching the fire will work out that if he builds a bigger kettle, he'll be able to lift a bigger kettle lid. Although, as we saw at Effing Forest, he soon learns that it's not as simple as that. They're not all as bright and clever as Dick Simnel." Harry snorted. "Stupid hayseeds! Not a patch on our Dick and his lads. All they've done is leave their old mum bound for the poorhouse." And Sir Harry harumphed, a full-blown harumph.